The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Brendan O'Neill and Frederick DeBoer are the guests this week as we dedicate this week's episode to the question of punching Nazis. Brendan O'Neill is the editor of Spiked Online, a publication that I would describe as having an attitude that is both socialist and libertarian in the American sense of the word. They advocate both expanding the range of human freedom and expanding capitalist economic growth, despite being smart enough to know why capitalist economic growth can only occur when the mass of humanity is fettered. Yeah, I don't get it either. Frederick DeBoer is a writer for publications such as Jacobin, The Washington Post, Foreign Policy, and other publications. He is a professor at Brooklyn College and describes himself as having conventionally leftist views. A socialist, he is something of a mixer and has engaged in many Twitter battles with neoliberals like Jonathan Chait and Sadie Doyle. This episode is a mashup. It is the result of cutting down two interviews into a single polyphonous episode. Two otherwise disparate voices have been brought together here, not because they agree, but because they both have opinions and were willing to share them. To underline the point further, let me say again, there are two people in this episode and two different opinions. DeBoer is the man with the American accent. O'Neill is the Brit. It's Wednesday, February 8th, 2017, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. Thanks goes to members of the Zero Books Club. Zero Books Club members receive access to the Inside Zero Books podcast, which sometimes consists of unedited or full-length interviews from the Zero Squared podcast, and sometimes features conversations with Zero Books readers about the state of the left. The music you're listening to right now is Smash Things Up by Chikung. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Brendan O'Neill and Frederick DeBoer discussing punching Nazis. But I wanted to talk to you about punching Nazis and free speech. What is your formal position, or what is your take on this trend towards embracing political violence against the extreme right?
I have to say, I think it's pretty pathetic. My policy, if one has a policy on punching Nazis, if they are organized and if they are involved in rough or violent action against certain communities or certain groups or certain left-wing outfits, then I think it's perfectly legitimate to defend yourself, to hit them, to chase them off the streets, and all those other forms of action are perfectly legitimate in that kind of conflictual political scenario. But what we have with the punching of Richard Spencer is actually one of the most tragic things I can remember seeing on the left in modern times, which was this really kind of vicarious thrill that came from watching this guy being punched. And it wasn't even a very good punch. The guy missed him with his fist and kind of hit him with the side of his arm. You think, God, where did this bloke learn how to fight? It's not very impressive. And what I think it became for the left, it became this cathartic moment. In fact, a Guardian writer referred to it as a cathartic moment. It became a very therapeutic thing where feeling increasingly disorientated and increasingly disconnected from ordinary people who keep having the temerity to surprise the left and the liberal world by voting for things they shouldn't be voting for. In that situation, what we had are kind of left-wing activists and observers leaping upon this one punch with all their glee and with great excitement and holding it up as evidence that this is the fight back. I thought it was really, really sad and actually spoke volumes, not about the strength of Nazism, which I think is a tiny, infinitesimally small problem, but about the impotence of the left and the weakness of the left, that they could get so excited about this one lame punch.
You know, I am not immune to these memes. My reaction to seeing Richard Spencer punched, my immediate reaction was some terrible glee, I'll admit it. And then I enjoyed the memes that came across my Facebook newsfeed for a while. But then there was one that my son posted, which I thought really got to something. It started with an interview with Jeb Bush, and someone had asked him if he could time travel back in time and kill baby Hitler, whether he would do it. And he said, well, of course, you got to stand up, you know, you got to do it. And then the next shot was of him putting on a hoodie, which was from some other context. And then the next shot was the guy in the hoodie running up to Richard Spencer and punching him.
Yeah, you know, I love a good meme. I love memes. I share memes. They make me laugh. But memes aren't real life. And I thought what I found really depressing was the way in which memes became the focus of politics. They became the stuff of politics following that punch. And it was almost as if they were the real thing in the left's worldview post-Trump. You know, I've seen a cartoon comparing the punching of Richard Spencer to Captain America punching actual Nazi soldiers from those old cartoon strips. I've seen people say things like, why do you think it's bad to punch a Nazi? That's how we took them on in the 1930s. And I just want to say to these people, please stop embarrassing yourself. This is self-humiliation. You know, in the 1930s, Western leftists got off their asses, traveled to Spain, learned how to fire a gun, got shot, got beaten up, actually fought against fascists in a meaningful way. That is not comparable to sitting at home in your bedroom and watching a 1 minute video on a loop and laughing at it and posting on Twitter about how much joy you have derived from it. So I think what it really revealed was, actually it revealed a lot about the post or the Trump era rather, which is the left doesn't know how to compute this. It doesn't know what's going on. It doesn't know how to confront what's going on. And so it's increasingly latching on to small incidents like this, or indeed onto large protests, which are quite unfocused, and just hoping that this is the resistance. And I think they need to think a bit more and organize themselves a bit more and have a word with themselves rather than going in for all this stuff.
Well, let's have a word with ourselves right now. I wanted to ask you your opinion about Black Bloc tactics and the mentality, the sort of siege mentality that supports them. What do you think about the debate around that, around punching Nazis, around rioting? And what's your opinion there?
Well, I've said this before. The left fixates on moral questions of those kinds of tactics, in part as a means to avoid discussing the efficacy of those tactics. You know, when you say Black Bloc tactics, I think that's very important, because a tactic, right, is a technique that you're applying towards a particular strategic end. It's a means and not an end to itself. We endlessly debate whether it's moral to punch a Nazi, right? Meanwhile, what difference does it make if Richard Spencer gets punched in the face, right? People say that they understand that it doesn't make any difference, but there's such a fixation on it. There's such a relentlessness in remixing it and making memes out of it and reveling in it and congratulating ourselves about it that it seems to me to suggest that people are taking it far too seriously. If we want to debate the Black Bloc, let's ask, what is the purpose of Black Bloc tactics today? What are our goals? Which of our goals can they plausibly achieve, and how? The answer to that question to me seems to be straightforwardly none of them, that there is no coherent sort of vision of change, no sort of political theory of change where anyone can articulate to me how Black Bloc tactics save us from a situation where, you know, this demagogue, this nativist, this proto-fascist controls the American military. has the nuclear codes, has predator drones, has tanks and MRAPs, has snipers, right? And it just seems to me to be an awful distraction, just a waste of our time to spend so much of our energy debating the use of political violence when even the most optimistic person can't sort of define a situation in which political violence would lead to our taking power.
Well, it all gets down to debates about propaganda, whether it's good propaganda to punch a Nazi in the face because it sends fear into the hearts of your enemies.
Well, I mean, think about it this way. If you had some prominent left-wing figure was at a protest and a Trump supporter came up and punched them in the face, would the left suddenly stand down and say, oh, no, they're going to punch us. Let's not leave the house?
No.
Right. No, literally the opposite, right? We'd be inspired. We'd say, you can't scare us. We're going to come out in even greater force. Like the idea that Richard Spencer getting punched is going to make people afraid to be alt-right is a total betrayal of how basic psychology works.
What do you think the character of the Trump threat is? And let me, before I let you answer that, let me tell you just a little bit about what I think the character of the Trump threat is. I think that that Trump does represent some sort of neo-fascist or far-right, very extremely reactionary movement, and that he's probably not even the worst example on the world stage right now, not even the worst example that's seeking state power, but he's a very bad – this is a very bad moment. It's a very dangerous moment, and that the state, the U.S. state, is split against itself in a way that I've never seen before. I am quite concerned. I mean, just yesterday, he apparently threatened to send troops to Mexico. I worry that this is some sort – that this could build to be something that is world historic and that it maybe is not identical to, you know, the 1930s, but that would compete in some ways with that moment. What do you think? Am I overreacting?
I think maybe you are, but you're not the only one, so you're in good company. I have real trouble with the suggestion that Trump is a fascist or a neo-fascist or on his way to becoming a fascist. I just think the word fascist and the word fascism have been overused to the point of having become utterly meaningless. This is not an original point. George Orwell made this point in the 1940s, where he said people use the word fascists so much that it now basically just means things I don't like. I think we've gone even further down that route now. And I think, again, that the bandying about of the word fascist to describe Trump, who is clearly a right-wing and authoritarian leader, I think, again, it speaks to this lack of an anchor among his opposition, a lack of a framework through which to understand these events in a way that is meaningful and connected to what's going on in the world. To my mind, fascism is a very, very specific thing, and no one benefits from pretending that it's something else. Fascism, to my mind, is a situation where the rulers of society face a grave or existential threat from organized labor or from a very well-organized left, and incapable of dealing with that threat, they allow themselves to be replaced or they allow themselves to be fronted by a mass movement that is usually of a paramilitary nature, and they use that to instigate a class war or a civil war to get things back onto an even keel. That's what fascism is, and it's occurred rarely in history. I mean, obviously, there's Germany. I think, in fact, Italy is a more classic example of fascism. Possibly Spain, although even there, I think it's slightly different to what I would understand fascism to be. I don't think people use the word in relation to Latin American regimes. I think that's better understood as Bonapartism or you know, the exploitation of populism. The idea that it exists in America, that those conditions exist in America now, seems utterly fanciful to me. There is no organized labor in any threatening way, anyway. There is no mass movement of paramilitary people willing to fight to the death to defend the Trump regime. So none of those conditions that I think satisfy the term fascism exist. What I think people mean when they say fascist is, I really hate Trump. That's what they're saying. And but which is fine. I absolutely don't have a problem with people really hating Trump. I do have a problem with them misusing the word fascist, because I think it obscures what was unique about these episodes in history. And it makes people feel extremely scared in the present, which I think is ultimately self-defeating.
Well, I think the other thing that they mean is that Trump's racial scapegoating, combined with his populist rhetoric and his kind of neo-Keynesian approach and protectionist approach, nationalist approach to economics, puts him into the category of at the very least, a very right-wing populist reactionary. And that there's a danger that the scapegoating will help to set up conditions in the future that might lead to something like, I don't know, civil war, but some sort of popular attack upon minorities, you know, organized through the state.
I can't see that, but even if it, you know, well, I can see how he scapegoated minorities, particularly in his campaign in relation to the things that he said about Mexicans and his continuing threat or now insistence that he's going to fortify the security barrier or build a wall, his concern about Muslims, his very censorious and shrill and overblown concern about the threat of Islam. Clearly, he has some very problematic right-wing, quite hard right-wing tendencies. But even that doesn't fall into the description of fascism. I mean, numerous governments have done things like this over the past few decades. The British Labour government did it in the 1960s in relation to Asians in Kenya who were moving to Britain in huge numbers because of problems in Kenya. And the Labour government instituted what was, in essence, a racial law that would prevent their ability to move in huge numbers. So that kind of thing has happened before in numerous different ways. Right now, in the European Union, has basically a two-tiered approach to immigration, where you have free movement within the EU itself, which means Poles can move to Britain and Britons can move to Germany and so on. But at the same time, the EU pays African dictators to stop their people from trying to get to Europe. And the consequences of that are absolutely dire. People are dying and sinking to the bottom of the Mediterranean in their thousands, which makes Trump's travel ban on those seven Muslim countries look like a tea party in comparison. So all that kind of stuff happens in various different ways. I think no one benefits from calling it fascism. I think all that does is it gives the opponent of those things a kind of a cheap thrill, or it allows them to pretend that they are engaged in a really historic conflict, when in fact, the truth might be that they are dealing with something fairly normal as far as Western politics goes.
Okay, so one more round on this and then we'll move on, but let's do a thought experiment for a moment. And I understand that you reject this, but let's grant this premise that, in fact, Trump and other leaders like him do represent some sort of neo-fascist threat. Is attacking someone like Richard Spencer or violently rioting outside of the UC Berkeley campus where Milo's going to speak? Would that be a useful or smart tactic against actual fascists?
If these were real fascists, if fascism was an actual thing in 21st century America, in the way that I've described it, where the state kind of encourages a very large group of paramilitary forces to take on the left or the opposition or whoever else it might be, then it wouldn't be okay to punch Richard Spencer or to riot at Berkeley. You ought to be arming yourself and setting up, secret radio stations and publishing underground newspapers. See, this is the thing that really I find very, very interesting. If people really thought that Trump represented a new form of kind of American fascism, they wouldn't be marching through the streets with vagina hats on their heads and holding up placards with witty slogans that they very keenly hope will be tweeted and retweeted thousands of times, which is seems to me what those placards are designed to do, they wouldn't be doing that if they took their own arguments seriously. They would be thinking very carefully and very hard about how to confront this fascism. So there's a real disconnect between the language that they use to describe the Trump phenomenon and the actions that they take in response to it. And I think that disconnect reveals that the language simply isn't right and doesn't work. And then what happens, I think, is that the punching of Spencer becomes this very therapeutic thing. And then it does start to take on a quite censorious element. Because basically what you're saying, if these aren't particularly well-organized fascists and they're not engaged in actual violence and so on, then punching them is simply a way of stopping them from talking. So that, I think, is an act of censorship. In another situation, punching a fascist might be perfectly legitimate and make sense because they're threatening you or your community. Mm-hmm. But not in this situation. My real concern with Spencer is that he has been made into a foil by the left, a foil for their own lack of clarity and their own inability to connect with what's going on, and their feeling that they have lost vast swathes off the electorate to a different kind of politics. And so what they've done is they've made Spencer into this kind of bogeyman that they can all rage against and scream against, this kind of Emmanuel Goldstein figure who they can have a two-minute hate against. And the consequence of that is twofold. Firstly, they don't actually stop to think about the current political conditions and what might be done about them. And secondly, even worse, Richard Spencer is transformed from a fairly sad, not particularly interesting character into the most dangerous man in America, courtesy of the left.
I think it's important for any person who is invested in the cause of social justice, as I am, to recognize that one of the things that makes the current situation so difficult is that establishment power is very good at keeping up appearances. I think part of the reason why Trump has sparked so much panic is because he doesn't keep up appearances in the way that other people have. Now, obviously, it doesn't make him any better. I mean, I think he's worse than a lot of the alternatives. But if you look at like the relationship between neo-imperialism and old school imperialism, right? Part of what made the Iraq War shocking was it seemed like a sort of a throwback to a different era when the United States or other countries would just invade other countries, you know, sort of directly. Now we have these systems where we don't sort of undertake sort of direct imperialism. We don't, you know, send the Marines to Latin American nations to sort of steal their resources. But you do have situations where companies like Chiquita Banana and Coke are allowed to operate with total impunity in those areas where they commit terrible crimes and where the weight of American power prevents them from being punished. And so you have a situation where, yes, I, on balance, right, I still think that's preferable to the Marines landing in Guatemala. Yeah. But what that makes it, what that sort of sense of normalcy and that that sort of appearance keeping of we with sort of respect borders and the rule of law, that makes it more difficult for all of us who want to resist because it blunts the sort of the optics of the situation. And you have to recognize that part of what Trump has been such a fissure in the American political imagination is that he has upset conservatism's sort of ability to be racist but to hide it, to be homophobic but to couch it in the language of religious freedom, to have all of these reactionary positions that they've become much better at sort of hiding. Trump doesn't hide them, and so he is a potentially a more dangerous adversary, but he's also sort of laid the stakes out a little bit more clearly.
Yeah, I think that the other thing is that he is not liked by the establishment. Like, he truly is a wild card. This is not what anyone who has had power up to now wanted, including his own party. So, you know, he is, and so that means for a certain demographic, a rebellious demographic, they actually see a kindred spirit there. Because of that. Go ahead.
No, yeah, I just think that, I mean, he's boorish, you know. I mean, like, we like our killers to be genteel, right? Like, you know, Henry Kissinger has literally millions of people's blood on his hands. He is one of the great villains of history, certainly, maybe, you know, one of the great villains of the second half, certainly one of the great villains of the second half of the 20th century. But he is feted by Democrats as well as by Republicans because he maintains this sort of, you know, this sort of genteel, respectful kind of stance on murder. Trump doesn't do that, right? Trump is just sort of in your face, like all id, like I'm this sort of horrific monster and it's all surface, you know?
I'm kind of a fan of Slavoj Žižek. You know who he is? So yep. Slavoj Žižek has this great anecdote. He says, you know, things always mean more than they appear to on the surface. So, for instance, if you go to an academic lecture and you find it really dull, afterwards you don't say to the person, I found it really dull. You say, oh, that was interesting. Because if they know that if you weren't really praising it, then you probably didn't like it. And if you go to a lecture and afterwards you say to the person, that was deadly dull, they don't think, oh, he didn't like my lecture. They think, that guy wants to kill me. He's out for my job. Something's going on. And so there's that same sensibility with Trump. It's like Trump says things that were underneath the surface, what was what the Republicans really meant, and he says them outright. So what is he holding back from us? I mean, that's where you start to get the visions of the death camps from, you know, because he'll say things that were unsaid before.
Right. I mean, I hope that I don't live to regret saying this. I'm not sure that he has the sort of coherent ambition to desire death camps, really. Like, it's, you know, the degree to which any of this is tied to any sort of broader vision of how the world should be is unclear to me. Like, all these people are writing these, like, what is Trumpism kind of essays, which to me implies much more of a coherent ideology than he probably already actually has, you know.
You don't think that Bannon is setting the terms for that more than he is or something like that?
I mean, I think Steve Bannon is a dangerous fellow. It's not clear to me that he's any more dangerous or even equally dangerous as like the neoconservatives who dominated the W. Bush era White House, right? I mean, they had a very well-oiled machine, an ideological apparatus that was tied to think tanks and magazines. They were well-funded. They had a very clear vision of the world, which was a world based on American domination that had saw almost limitless war. Steve Bannon is certainly dangerous and certainly a reprehensible figure. It's just not clear to me that he is competent enough and has enough of a machine behind him to be as dangerous as they were.
My wife is going to nursing school now. You know, our kids are older, so she's going back to school to get a career going. And right after the election of Trump, her school issued an email letting everyone know that that there was therapy available to the university, and that if people were feeling traumatized by the election results, that they could come in and talk about it. And I found that infuriating. Because first of all, if Clinton had won, that email wouldn't have gone out. So, like, you know, to say that, I suppose, makes me sound like, you know, a Trump supporter or something. But it was obviously not actually about psychology or real therapy. It was actually a political email, but it was in the guise of therapy. So it was, what infuriated me about it was it reduced the range of responses to Trump's election down to the basically self-care. And so it was very depoliticizing and really undermined, I thought, a moment where people might be able to take a step back and say, I need to do something differently. I need to get involved differently in politics in the state, you know?
Yeah. I completely agree with that, and I think that speaks to the way in which a certain kind of left-wing politics has been moving, which is effectively into the world of self-care. That's where it has been going. But my concern, which is not a nice concern to have, it's what I feel, is that the protests as well, particularly the Women's March, were also part of that self-care world. It's just that everyone was doing it together. It felt very much to me like a lonely crowd. We had vast numbers of people, but because there was no clear political focus or clear political demand except an expression of exasperation or fury or anger with Trump the fascist, it did feel very much like people coming together to feel better. And in fact, there was one article in Britain which described it as a sharing of love among strangers, which I thought was a very strange way to talk about what other people describe as the resistance. So I'm worried about the way in which even the larger physical protests have that component of not quite wanting to confront this politically or intellectually, and instead doing it at quite an emotional level. I have to say it differs from protest to protest. I thought the protests in America in response to the travel ban, the executive order on travel, I thought they were positive and had a lot going for them. I thought the taxi drivers refusing to go to JFK was very positive. I thought the way in which activist lawyers got involved was very inspiring. So there was a lot in that protest which I thought worked very well. The European protests, especially in Britain, in response to the travel ban, I thought were less positive. And actually, they concerned me a great deal, primarily because of the fascist imagery and the Holocaust imagery. I think there were a lot of placards saying this is the new Hitler and we know how this ends, and it was Holocaust Memorial Day the other day, so don't let Trump get away with it. These people are playing with fire, because if you hold the Holocaust up as something that is actually quite routine and wasn't very special at all, and in fact is now being repeated in Trump when he says stupid things or signs stupid orders, what you're doing is you're chipping away at the uniqueness and the barbarism of the Holocaust. And you're actually sending a message to the far right in particular that maybe they were right all along, that the Holocaust wasn't that special. So I'm deeply concerned about the way in which that language is used about Trump, because I think it is undermining history, and it is making the present seem more awful than it is. It's not that bad.
The women's marches were successful beyond my wildest dreams. It was something like 1.5% of the American population went to a protest that weekend, which is amazing. Then you say, okay, that's 1.5% that protested, which means that 98.5% didn't. Let's suppose we threw this general strike. I think it would be incredibly optimistic to predict that we'd get a third as many people as went to the protests, because people, for obvious reasons, don't want to risk their jobs. So let's pretend that we get like a half percentage point of workers not going to their jobs. You know, is that going to be enough to depose Trump? I think that the answer is clearly no. It's just, you know, this is where a lot of my writing originates from, which is, despite what people say constantly, I don't harbor secret reactionary beliefs. I have sort of perfectly conventional left-wing beliefs, but I have a series of critiques of the sort of tactical and strategic instincts of the left and the Democratic Party also, that I've been applying for years. And unfortunately, I keep being proved right in terms of the problem with our tactics.
Well, let's talk about the Women's March for a minute. I thought that it was a very successful event, but I didn't expect that it would be successful politically, because it didn't seem to be political. It seemed to be cultural. It was, which was fine. I mean, my aunt went to that protest, and my daughter went to that protest, and I was all for that protest. I think Trump is a scum, but I understood why they were out there, and it was a statement and a symbolic gesture, but it was not a political act. And it, you know, not everything has to be.
I mean, I think it's really important that we be clear about with the, you know, protests. You know, I think that it's a very kind of naive vision of protest that you sometimes hear lately, that like the idea of a protest is to sort of prompt an immediate and material political outcome. So I've been, you know, there's been this sort of ultra left critique of the Women's March protests, which I think were quite dumb, because I also thought that the Women's March was a fantastically encouraging. But this critique is sort of like, well, if you look at the, you know, the anti-Iraq war protests, they were the largest protests in history up to that point. And nothing happened. The war still went on with as planned, as though, I mean, I can't imagine hardly anyone who went to those protests. I went to those protests, thought that they were going to like stop the war. But that's not the point, right? Like, part of the point is you register the objection for one reason, so that history can never say that no one had a better idea, right? And also because you understand that you are gradually building up a record of alternative opinion that does eventually make a difference. Lyndon Johnson ended up not pursuing the nomination for president because he had become so toxically unpopular within his own party because of the anti-Vietnam War movement. If you went to an individual anti-Vietnam War movement in anti-war protest in like 1966, you couldn't the next day say, "Oh, we beat the bastards. The Vietnam War's over." But what you could do is take part in a continuity of action that eventually had world historic consequences. And
I'm going to jump in because this is something I actually was one of those far leftists that mentioned the lead up to the war in Iraq as an example to think about when we were thinking about the Women's March. Not that it was a complete slam on that march, but it was just something to keep in mind, right? So, I mean, I wasn't around during the Vietnam War era, but I was around when we went into, in 91, I was 20 then, and I was around in the protests against the first Iraq misadventure. I was around for the second one, and those protests, my understanding is, had a very different character from the protests against the Vietnam War. The protests against Vietnam War were happening while the war was happening rather than before. The protests against the Vietnam War were not as connected to either party. And I don't know. There seemed to be mechanisms in place when it came to organizing protests against and a mindset in place when it came to organizing protests against the war in Iraq, which by their nature were accepting there would be no political consequences from the start. Like in my organization, PPRC, there was a meeting a year before the invasion of Iraq where they were planning the kind of protests they would have when we invaded Iraq. So that means that they accepted that consequence a year in advance before it was really known to most of the public that there would be an invasion. You know, that it was before the Bush administration got its shit together to organize the invasion, the protest movement was already organizing the big protest against it.
Yeah, I mean, I see what you're saying. I do think it's important to sort of keep alive the sort of matters of political possibility. But we are constrained by, well, on the left, we're constrained by many things. We're constrained by material reality. The reality is that there was no force that was going to stop the United States from invading some majority Muslim country other than Afghanistan after 9/11. That the political conditions were such that there was such nationalist bloodlust sort of ambiently over the country that we were going to go in somewhere. It seems now to me like that was very clear. I mean, the other, you know, the two questions. I mean, like the first question is like, you know, what's the alternative? I mean, if this terrible war was inevitable, does that mean that we should not have gone and registered our objection to it? I mean, you know, if a bad thing is inevitable and you can either object to it publicly or not, you might as well object to it. But the other thing is then this gets bound up in the question of the left's sort of relationship to the Democratic Party, which if there was going to be any political vehicle that might have stopped the Iraq war, it might have been the Democratic Party. But of course, they didn't. Prominent members of Democrat leadership supported the Iraq war, including Hillary Clinton. Again, was just a matter of where the country was in 2002 and 2003. I mean, it was a really dark time for this country, and that was probably inevitable.
who benefits from moral panics about fascists and Nazis? The people who benefit is the state. I mean, you only have to look at Cable Street, the great Cable Street protests in Britain in the 1930s, where the state used those as an excuse to introduce public order acts, ostensibly to control displays of Nazi sympathy. But in fact, of course, they were used a lot against the left. We've seen this again and again over the past few decades, where the left, instead of confronting the far right or right wing ideas in an intellectual, strong-minded, sometimes physical way, it too often goes running to the state or apes the state's methods for dealing with these problems. And we often see new legislation or new rules or new speech codes designed to control the far right, but very often used to control the far left as well. So the left has got to learn not to use police tactics, not to phone the police, not to call on university management to help them out, not to look to officialdom to create protective zones for minority groups. It has to stand up for itself and be independent and be autonomous and trust in people's ability to work out what is a good idea and what is a bad idea.
Okay, last question. Do you think this is a good moment for organizing for radical political change? Could this be a moment ripe for real, I don't know, I'm reluctant to say revolutionary, but revolutionary change?
I'm not convinced because, you know, there's a real issue here which complicates everything, which is that part of me is thinking, how can I engage with these protesters and talk to them and see what they're thinking and so on? But then another part of me is actually more interested in engaging with people who voted for Trump. I'm more interested in those people. I find them intriguing. And I think on some issues, they might actually be more progressive. For example, on industry, on economic growth, on not thinking the environment is under threat and we're all going to die in 10 years' time, in not buying into what have become mainstream ideas on the left, but actually are not particularly positive or progressive. I think I was watching the Jacobin magazine did a conference, the anti-inauguration, and they put the video online. And I thought I'll watch this to see what the left is saying about Trump's inauguration. It's one of the most depressing things I've seen in years because, firstly, Naomi Klein comes on and is treated like a goddess. And basically says we have to stop fossil fuels. So you have a situation where large numbers of people who work in the fossil fuel industry or in traditional manufacturing vote for change, vote for Trump, reject the Clintonite establishment. And the first thing that's said at this anti-inauguration conference is, let's get rid of fossil fuels. I mean, so little self-awareness is incredible. And then other speakers come on and talk about how Brexit gave rise to the worst racism Britain has seen since the Second World War and so on and so on. And I just thought, this tells me that the left has no clue where people are at. They have no clue that the value people attach to the idea of work and having a job and having industry and creating greater economic growth in order to create greater wealth. They have no idea of people's aspiration for autonomy, which I think Brexit expressed very well, people's aspiration not to be governed by so many layers of bureaucracy. Until the left understands that people want to be free and people want to be wealthy, and until they understand that that involves stripping away bureaucracy rather than propping it up and interfering with nature rather than treating it as sacred, until they understand those things, I don't think they'll get anywhere, and they certainly won't be holding any revolutions.
You've been a critic of what others call political correctness, and I think you've probably gotten a ton of shit for that. Mm-hmm. What would you say about the kind of outrage and perhaps political correctness today? Do you think that is still even a problem now that Trump's in office? Are we to be more tolerant of it now?
Well, I mean, so as you hinted in your question, I don't, I am frequently cast as a critic of political correctness or identity politics. I try to avoid those terms. I mean, I can't say that I've never used them, but I just find those terms to be sort of deliberately misleading. And, you know, they have been, you know, claimed and reclaimed so many times that I don't know what we're talking about. I would call myself a critic of a certain set of liberal to left political positions that are maximally invested in language and symbolism that depend upon – that see change as fundamentally occurring at the level of the individual, that thinks that we'll achieve a better world through individual people regulating their own behaviors, and that are all bound up in a sort of a conception of all political problems as problems of mind, right? So if you look at like the discourse of privilege, well, of course, in the basic sense that some people enjoy greater privileges than others, and that those are structural facets of society, and that that's a bad thing, right? That we need to address those that inequality. I'm of course completely on board. But if you look at things like, you know, the obsession with checking your privilege, which is a ritual whereby people who are in more powerful positions, more privileged positions, sort of inform the world that they're aware of their privilege. It's a pretty good indication of what I'm talking about, because it's not clear at all to me, and has never been clear, what that does for anyone, what the ritualistic checking of privilege actually does. I mean, there's an implication that if someone checks their privilege, they will then move on to sort of greater action that will help to sort of tear down these inequalities. And if that's true, I'm happy about it. But I have always argued that by focusing so relentlessly on what's individualistic, on what's linguistic, on what's a matter of sort of individual social behaviors, we're fundamentally fighting against the effort to see these problems as sort of societal and structural. So now we're in the era of Trump, right? And what's happened is that you've gotten this really passionate resistance from liberal and left sort of sources, for very good reason, to this regime, to not just Trump's presidency, but to total domination by Republicans of the Congress and of the state houses. And so when you have this sort of fired up base that's mad against Trump, people respond to that by sort of circling the wagons, right? They pull tighter together and they start to regulate their own spaces more and more. And so if anything, the discourse of political correctness has become more powerful. But I think that it's a perfect example of just the sort of absurdity of priorities right now on the broad left, where you say, well, you can't do microaggressions in here, right? Like, you know, don't do yoga because that's cultural appropriation, where it, you know, a nativist demagogue is in the White House, right? There is this reaction by the left where the worse things get, the more sort of quotidian and minute our political interests are, right? Like, we respond to really big problems by taking the object of politics and looking at it closer and closer and closer. It is simply my observation of the way that the world works, that even if you got every individual person to follow your really strict code of ethics, which you can't do, by the way, the world will still fundamentally be an unjust place. And there's been such a refusal on the part of liberals and the left to ask themselves whether that discourse can actually solve the problems that it's intended to solve.
Last question. Now, you didn't really want me to ask about your little skirmish online, so I won't ask directly about that, but I do want to ask this. Do you think that the way people are interacting and the kinds of debates that are happening online are detrimental right now? Do you find this to be a problem that you have any kind of idea about how we could solve it? Or what is your feeling about the way the discourse, I guess, is going online?
Yeah, I just think that right now the left is in a really dangerous place, in that it is deeply, deeply antithetical to any internal criticism. I think that there is a real sort of shoring up, a circling of the wagons, a sort of defensive crouch that the left has adopted, where it wants to sort of – so many people want to write out of the movement anyone who's sort of internally critical of the way that we're doing things. I as someone who has been doing this for a long time, who's been a critic of – a left critic of left-wing practice for a long time. I can't remember a time when asking basic tactical and strategic questions was so unpopular. And that seems to me to be just totally the contrary to what we need right now. When you're in a political crisis, and we are absolutely in a political crisis, you must think clearly. It's more important than ever right now that the left think very, very carefully about what it wants and about what the best means are to get what it wants. And if you're eliminating the space where critics can operate, if you are denying the fairness or the potential of someone to be deeply invested in the left and to still criticize our tactics, I think that you're doing Trump's work for him. I think that we desperately need a healthy debate about what's best for our movement. And shutting that down is ultimately going to hurt the very people it's supposed to help.